Birding is a wonderful hobby, and with some basic know-how, maybe a little decent equipment, and above all, some patience, you can count on seeing a lot of wonderful birds. But sometimes the most exciting sightings are birds that really have no business showing up where they do. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Will Russell is co-founder and managing director of Wings. It's an international bird tour company, and he has taught about birds at the college level. He's researched questions of bird identification, bird distribution, and ecology, and he is co-author of the book we're going to be talking with him about. It's Rare Birds of North America, and we are pleased to have him with us today. If you have questions or comments, I wonder, have you been lucky enough to see a bird that you had no business seeing? It was out of place. Maybe you've witnessed a vagrant. What was it and where? Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org or post on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. We'd certainly love to hear from you. And we're certainly loving to hear from our guest today, Will Russell. Will, thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Larry, it's a pleasure.
We have the title of your book, written with Steve Holland in Lewington, is Rare Birds of North America. And your definition of rare, I think it's really cool. And it's different from what people might expect. So maybe explain how you define it for the purposes of this book.
Well, we define it simply that birds for which there are fewer than 5 records per year for the period under consideration, that was from 1950 on to the present day, we arbitrarily define that as rare in North America. I should point out that almost all these birds are not rare in their normal range. They can be common, indeed abundant. So that's the baseline. And we hedged that a bit in some cases. Bird watching became popular, very popular in the 1950s. So as the 50s morphed into the 60s and 70s, an increasing number of people were in the field. So many eyes means more sightings. So a bird that might have been fairly common in the 1980s, because there were 10 times as many people looking for it as in the 1950s, we had to make adjustments for those sorts of calculations. And then there were some occasions where birds were very rare for years, decades sometimes, and then all of a sudden there'd be thousands of them that occurred in 1 year. So this is not a precise deal, as you can see.
Oh, man. Well, what causes these birds to get off course? I'm sure there are a lot of reasons.
There are a lot of reasons, and it's imperfectly understood. Most adult birds that are migrants have a bicoordinate navigation system, as best we know, which allows them to go from point A to point B and make adjustments en route if there is some disturbance, like weather, which may push them off course. Birds in their first year don't have this sophisticated a system. They know basically which direction they want to go, but if they're pushed off course, way off course, they may continue on that line, not knowing that they are hundreds or even thousands of miles off from the point they wish to get to. The most interesting subset of all this are birds that get so far off course and all of a sudden find themselves flying into a very intense headwind. They want to go in the direction, let's just say for point of discussion, south, but there's a 40-knot wind blowing from the south in their face. And at some point, and we have no idea what this tipping point is, and it varies by species, they decide that there is no future in beating themselves up trying to go in the direction they want to go, so they turn around and simply fly downwind or coast downwind. We don't know the details of their behavior. This is probably a good strategy, because if the alternative is burning up all your fuel without getting anywhere and there's a big ocean underneath you, and I should say at this point, this has to happen over water. If it happened over land, the birds would simply drop down and rest in the land. But many birds migrate over water. In eastern North America, a lot of the birds that breed in Wisconsin will go over the Gulf of Mexico. Many of them will go over the Caribbean to make landfall in South America. So there are a large number of species in eastern North America, and these are talking about common North American birds, that end up over water, and they run into these winds, and they turn around, and they go downwind, and this can lead to anomalies like thousands of things landing in Nova Scotia in mid or late October, months after they would have normally left Nova Scotia, and that assumes that they bred there in the first place. Or in some cases, they get blown all the way across to southwestern England. And it's we're coming to learn that these birds, these tiny little packages, can go much, much further than we ever thought they could. It's astounding aeronautical efficiency.
Yeah, absolutely. And the data, how are data typically collected on vagrants? I mean, where does it land?
Well, it's imprecise. The data that we collect is generated mostly by bird watchers. And they report their sightings to various state committees who evaluate them. Many of them are published in the journal North American Birds. That latter journal was the main source of our records, but we also looked at various reports from the state committees, and we didn't think it was our job to evaluate the reports. We accepted that the evaluations that were done by the state committees were correct, and we were willing to tolerate a moderate amount of error. If you have quite a few records, an outlier, an incorrect record, whether it was mistakenly reported or mistakenly identified, normally doesn't change the pattern that you can see when all the records are viewed as a whole. If there were very, very few records, like only 1, 2, 3, 5 for the entire period of our book, then we were much more careful in evaluating the records to make sure that we were comfortable that the species were correct. And in a couple of cases, we found out that we didn't think they were correct. And in those cases, the records committees, I think, ultimately both reversed themselves. But it was a very uncommon occurrence.
Really interesting. You know, as I look through your book, and it's a wonderful book, and the illustrations and that you have are absolutely wonderful. But I happened to open right away to the page that showed an Amazon kingfisher, and I thought to myself, if I'm looking out, I see kingfishers fairly often here in Wisconsin, and if I saw that an Amazon kingfisher, and the light was, if it was a little dark, I mean, the outline and the appearance of that bird is like the kingfishers that we see here all the time. I would not have been reporting seeing an Amazon kingfisher even if I saw one. And I expect there's a lot of that.
Yeah, you are with the 99% to use a percentage that's been bandied about a lot recently. Yeah, it requires experience, and Amazon kingfisher doesn't have the crest that belted kingfisher does, but I think most likely people look at birds, rare birds, and don't recognize them as being rare. They're birds. They may look like something they know, or if it doesn't, they may think, well, maybe it escaped, or maybe I didn't see it correctly. So, yeah, you're in the vast majority, and it's only a relatively small band of people with a passion for this sort of thing that acquired the skills necessary to detect rare birds with microsecond views.
Yeah. We have callers online. Again, you can join us at 1-800-642-1234. Vic in West Allis, thank you for calling. Hello. Vic, are you there? We got Vic there? That's weird. Let's try Luke in Van Dyne, Wisconsin next. Luke, hello.
Hi.
Thanks for calling.
Thank you. Good to hear your voice, Larry. I love your show.
Thank you.
I was going down Highway 41, latter part of September, I looked over. It was in the Theresa area. And it looked to me, and I said, those are probably herons. And then I said, wait a minute, those were blue herons. Is that possible?
Oh, yeah.
Well, Luke, absolutely. Blue herons, or great blue herons, as they're formally called, can migrate in significant flocks, and most of the great blue herons that winter in the northern part of their range, and that could be, I don't know the Wisconsin bird distribution well, but I would imagine in the southern part of the state, certainly in southern New England, they feed on mice because fresh water is normally frozen, and it's not unheard of in Massachusetts that I know better to see 8 or 10 great blue herons in a farm field or a marsh with no water waiting to spear some luckless rodent.
Yeah, and we... I had, when our home on Lake Monona, we had a heron that used to fish, a great blue that used to fish off our pier and would come up on the lawn occasionally. So there, you will see them distributed pretty, right across a broad part of Wisconsin. My favorite story about great blue herons, Luke, and Will, had to do with a caller who also lived on a lake, and their great blue heron would come up to their bird feeder and would sit stock still. And after a time, without moving, a gopher or a similar kind of animal would come up to get the bird seed that had fallen out of the bird feeder. And wham, the great blue would just, the chipmunk, grab, typically chipmunks, grab the chipmunk, and that was the end of the chipmunk, and down it would go. So it was hunting at a bird feeder. So pretty cool.
And standing like a statue.
Yeah, standing like a statue. Thanks, Luke. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Vic in West Allis. Hi, thanks for calling.
Hi. Hey, about 4 years plus, there was this beautiful little hummingbird out of Texas that came to Beloit, Wisconsin. I could not believe how many people were there waiting the whole day to see it. What was more amazing, we talked to people that came and flew out of West Virginia, Illinois, Ohio, Iowa, Michigan. And it just seemed to be quite common where you get something so rare that people will travel all over the United States just to see it. The only thing that was upsetting that when they captured, they sent it to the zoo in Chicago.
Oh.
And that was upsetting.
Oh. What do you think, Will?
Well, I'm trying to think of can you remember what the species was? Was it a green violet ear, which is a Mexican one? I'm just looking quickly to see if
I don't remember now.
I don't remember either, and I should, but I don't.
Oh, no.
But it caused such a sensation, and there were about 50, 60 people lined up.
Oh, it was a green-breasted mango, Judith says.
Green-breasted mango, yeah. Well,
is it quite common for people to travel all over the United States to see this rare bird?
there are a group of people, I would say probably several hundreds, that would abandon breakfast in mid-bite to travel across the country to see a bird that they'd never seen before. And there were some legendary occurrences. Years and years ago in Massachusetts, a Ross's gull was seen, and they've become more regular in the decades following that sighting, but it was unprecedented at the point. Up to then, if you wanted to see Ross's gulls, you had to go to Point Barrow, Alaska in September and watch these birds flying north along the north shore of Alaska into the dark. It was incredibly charismatic, and they were unbelievably beautiful. And I think that at that time, if you asked every bird watcher in North America what bird they would most want to see, 90% of them would have said Ross's gull. One showed up in Newburyport, Massachusetts, it was confirmed on day one. And on day two, there were 2,000 plus people there lined up waiting to see it. It was extraordinary outpouring, and this is repeated in smaller scale all over the U.S. and indeed the Western world that's interested in birds. A similar situation could occur in Great Britain or probably in Japan or Sweden or any one of the countries where birds are a national passion.
Yeah, really interesting. Thanks, Vic, for calling. Appreciate your call. I wonder, do people actually go looking for rare vagrants? Is it possible to do that, or is it just chance?
Well, there are a few hardcore birders who do go look for vagrants, and they mostly phrase them as social events. They'll set a weekend in November. They do this in Massachusetts and Maryland and who knows, maybe elsewhere in the country. And there'll be kind of rarity weekends where a lot of people who are interested in unusual birds will gather together and scout an area, maybe the same as a Christmas count, if sort of a defined area where people have watched birds at Christmas time for years, sometimes decades. And they'll go to that same area in early November, which is a prime time for vagrants, and try and find them. And they're surprisingly successful, not in first-order vagrants like first ones for North America or even first ones for the state, but they find things that are very, very rare. It's axiomatic that the more people you have on the ground looking, the more likely you are to find things, and some of those things turn out to be rare.
Will Russell, our guest today, he is co-author of Rare Birds of North America. I'm Larry Mueller. Judith Sears-Poisson, our producer on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're enjoying a fascinating talk with Will Russell about rare birds of North America, and I'm certainly inviting you to join in with your own questions or comments. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on my Facebook page. And to get to my Facebook page, it's titled The Larry Mueller Show. So I hope you'll go to that post your questions or comments. Or maybe you've had an experience with a rare bird. You want to let us know about it. Speaking of Facebook, we have a question from Greg. Have there been any reports of birds being transported across the country, trapped in a truck or some other sort of shipping method?
I don't know of any in North America, and part of the issues would be that when they got to where they were going, it would be difficult to know. If, let's say, they were found dead after the truck had departed, that they hadn't arrived by some other means, or that the bird might actually have been common in the place where it ended up. Certainly, I can't recall any occasion where someone had opened a container and out flew a bird. But there was an interesting occurrence similar to that in Kansas, I think it was, where containers that had been filled with military gear being repositioned from Western Europe to North America, inside one of the containers was a wryneck, which is an odd European woodpecker for which there are a couple of records in North America, in Alaska, none, of course, in Kansas. So this, who knows how it actually got in there, but it succumbed to the journey, and when it was found, it was in a dried-out state, but that was truly bizarre.
Oh, yeah. I was thinking back, not bird, but here in Wisconsin, we had a prairie dog turn up on a farm. And investigation revealed that it had come in a round bale, a large bale that had been transported from out west.
Well, I mean, it's thinking about the original question. Birds obviously can be transported by human means, and the one other species that might have been thought to have come in a grain car was a rosy finch from the west that turned up in Maine some years ago. But it's definitely possible, and clearly birds are transported in cages, and the question of whether or not a rare bird actually was wild occurring or was human assisted in some way is a perennial one in the rare birds world.
Yeah. And a Facebook comment from Kate, who said, hi, Will, from Kate and Frank in Duluth, Minnesota. We've had
We've had
a great season at Hawk Ridge, including a prairie falcon and red-shouldered hawk, which are unusual in Duluth, so you should come and visit, she says.
Well, I should say that Frank Micheletti, Kate's husband, is one of the great raptors specialists in North America, so and I'm a great admirer, so best wishes back to them.
Darlene and Stevens Point, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. I particularly like your term vagrant. I've seen snowy egrets, green herons, and once an American bittern in central Wisconsin, and I'm wondering where would we call to, if we're not an avid birder, where would we call to report a bird that we don't see very often, or that all of a sudden has shown up and we're not akin to have seen that?
Do you want to take that, Larry, or would you like me to?
Well, there's different ways. I mean, eBird would be certainly an online place to go for here in Wisconsin, but Will, what other place would you suggest?
Well, it isn't clear to me if the caller is a bird watcher with connections to other bird watchers in her region, but I would suppose that if there's a local Audubon Society or bird club within a few tens of miles, that would be the first place to start. There are many, many other places where one can report birds, but they require that you be embedded in the system, so to speak. And if you feel like you're the only one in your universe who watches birds, it might be easiest to reach out for a club or organization with bird interest and then refine your search once you've made some friends in that area.
Yeah. I do like eBird because it is it gives you a chance to see what other people have posted, too, here in Wisconsin. So that's kind of where I'd go first, too.
Well, and many people would do that as well. And if you're already a birder, that's a very good place to go, yes.
Yeah. Thanks, Darlene, for calling. Rod in Mason, Wisconsin. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi. Has there already been any confirmation on seeing that ivory-billed woodpecker that they were talking about? And what state was that in?
Well,
Arkansas, wasn't it?
That's a very controversial sighting. There were ivory-billed woodpeckers that were reported in Arkansas that historically were in from East Texas to the West Panhandle of Florida, at least this in the last 100 years, and even a more extensive range before that. There was a reliable report in the sense that the people who reported it were well-known and experienced naturalists, and various institutions undertook really a labor-intensive investigation. Hundreds of volunteers spread out over the marshes in the area of the sighting, and remote sound recording devices were put to trees. It was remarkable, and they were never able to find anything to support the original observation, which doesn't say that the initial observation was wrong, but there were hundreds of people over many months that were looking for it. So the air went out of that balloon, but it's still very controversial. There are people who think that the report was wrong, and there are others who think that it was probably right and think just chance has allowed this one or possibly two individuals to escape detection, and it's still a sore point in some areas.
Yeah.
But I think the general sense is now that the sighting was for some reason probably incorrect, and honorable people can make mistakes, and I think that's the general consensus.
I have a wood carving of an ivory-billed woodpecker, and that's maybe the closest. I'm sure it's the closest I'll ever get to seeing what an ivory-billed woodpecker looks like.
What a shame.
Yeah, what a shame. You can join in with, and thanks a lot for calling, Rod. Appreciate it very much. You can join in, too, at 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org, or you can post on my Facebook page. Just go to the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page, and you can post a question or a comment there. And birds that, I think you mentioned this earlier, that sometimes birds that were considered rare for a particular region can become common.
That's certainly true. Over time, usually a fair amount of time. I think my original comment was intended to say that birds that are rare in North America are usually common, sometimes very common in their normal range, which
elsewhere,
might be Western Europe or Asia or some other place. But to your point, birds that are very, very rare can become common. Some of the classic examples are cattle egrets, where the first records in North America were in the 50s, and by the 1990s there were millions of them scattered over the Northeast and the West, and although they've receded from their population highs, they're still very common in many parts of North America. So the populations can change, and sometimes very quickly, and of course, as your next guest will discuss, they can go from being unbelievably abundant to non-existent, too. The reverse can happen.
Kim in Boston, thank you for calling. Hello.
Hello. We had a great gray owl in the Mauston area. I think it was last year, the year before, and it drew people from all over the United States. We had photographers from New York. We had people from California. And within literally hours of it being spotted, we had people lined up photographing it and just watching.
Well, Ray Gray Owls are one of the most charismatic members of North America's avifauna, and there are many birds that I would drive a long way to see, but if I hadn't seen a great gray owl, I think my range is unlimited. So, yeah, I completely understand. And they, great gray owls are, along with a few other species that are dependent on a fluctuating food source in the north, rough-legged hawks, northern goshawks are a couple of other examples. When that food source crashes, those species just leave because they're living in harsh environments, and unless they're getting a lot of nutrition on a daily basis, they simply can't fight off the heat loss that the cold climate superimposes on them, even though they have extraordinary coats of feathers. So it's just wonderful. I'm delighted you had that experience.
Yeah, we had thanks, Kim, for calling. We had that experience in Madison a year ago, I think it is. He stayed in one area for more than a week, and it was really quite an event. Are raptors common vagrants?
Well, some of them are. The raptors that aren't dependent on soaring, those that migrate more by flying, soaring occasionally, but are perfectly capable of powering through if there are no thermals. For example, something like a broadwing hawk or Swainson's hawk that winter in mostly in South America, they may go down to South America and only rarely flap their wings. I mean, when they get aloft in the morning, and maybe when they settle in to rest at night. But for the rest of the day, they're going from thermal to thermal to thermal, so that these incredibly long-distance movements to South America take very little energy, and in fact, they're thought not even to feed during that entire process. But falcons and harriers, used to be called marsh hawks, northern harriers, and ospreys, and birds like that, which are powerful flyers, are subject to vagrancy, and there are a number of cases where Western European or Asian falcons have turned up either in the Northeast or in Alaska. And there have been a certain number of birds from Central America and Mexico that have moved up and occurred in the southern states or even further. These are not necessarily birds that are long-distance migrants, but young birds will wander, and occasionally food resources will vanish, as when in a drought large wetlands may simply disappear and the birds that were dependent on them disperse, and some of those dispersals can be surprisingly far-reaching, that will lead birds to appear hundreds or even thousands of miles away from when they're normally found.
Yeah, we've had eruptions of snowy owls in Wisconsin in the past few years, and that's, because of the problems in Canada with food, as you describe.
Yeah, well, it's if you can't feed yourself, I suppose this probably applies to most every living thing that's mobile. You pretty much have to look elsewhere.
Yeah. Karen in Jefferson, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hello there. I'm really enjoying the program, and it reminded me of a movie that came out 2 or 3 years ago called The Big Year, where, and it's a comedy, but very serious bird enthusiasts were trying to find rare birds and in 1 year and see how many they could find in 1 year, and then they would try to sabotage each other's successes and so forth. And it was funny, but you still saw beautiful scenery and learned a lot about birds. So it was. I liked it a lot. But I just wanted to know if there really is such a thing as a big year year where people count. And they even counted hearing the birds.
You should read the book, Karen, that the movie's based on. The book I interviewed the author of the book and had a lot of fun. Will, a comment from you?
You're exactly right. And as to Karen, Karen, people have account competitively down to the tiniest possible areas, probably certainly to counties and sometimes to townships, but the most spectacular ones are the big years that are national. And yeah, there are, I would think today there probably are a handful of people, 5 to 10 maybe, who are at present engaged in a big year. Some of them have unlimited resources and fly here and there. Others will hitchhike across the country. Some will take weekends from their jobs and fly to one end or the other, maximizing who knows how many credit cards. So yeah, it's a game that people play, and they play it with a passion and certainly competitively. But one comment you made, and it may have been true in the book's case, I can't remember, but I've certainly never seen, although these are very competitive, I've never seen or heard of anything underhanded in that somebody tried to prevent somebody else from seeing a bird. It's really very collegial mostly.
Yeah, and that's the case in the book. The people, the three guys in the book, did not try to sabotage.
Oh, okay. Maybe it was just to put comedy in the movie then.
Oh, yes.
Well, but the fact that there are big years are true. That is true.
Oh, yes.
Oh, for goodness sake.
Yeah.
and you know, the sort of the overall, the extent to which those people in the movie went is, as kind of Will was suggesting here, is quite quite the case, quite often the case.
Ooh. Well, that's
but you might really enjoy, since you liked the movie, you might really enjoy the book. And in fact, I like, it's one of those cases where, okay, I like the book better than the movie.
Okay.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling, Karen. Oh, man. Tom in Green Bay, it is your turn. Hi, Tom.
Hi. Comment on Broadway hawk migration, and same thing for Sweeney, since they do feed on migration. I'm a raptor bander, and typically early in the morning, and when they're coming down in the evening is when they're hunting. And also, if you watch the flocks, when they're going through, if you watch them closely, you're going to see a bird dip. You just sort of do a half little, just drop a few feet or something, and then you see the foot coming up to the beak. There are dragonflies, there are beetles, there are all sorts of insects up there in those thermals also. So they're actually feeding while they're up there floating around.
Well, as for Swainson's hawks, yeah, I completely agree. I'm in Arizona, and there are thousands moving through, and they do feed here. For broadwing hawks, the business of having thermals, insects up in the thermals, there certainly are insects up there, but I didn't know that, and thank you. I'll have to go back and look at that.
Yeah, that's a great point. Thanks very much for calling. We should talk a little more about your book and how you have it organized. It's a wonderful, wonderfully illustrated book, by the way.
Well, Ian Lillington is, in my view, the best bird artist of his generation. He's an unbelievably modest. I try and praise him for his artistry, and he says, "Well, in this wonderful soft British accent," he said, "I'm not an artist." He said, "I'm just an illustrator." He doesn't seem to realize, or else he's too modest to agree to it, that each of his paintings is in itself a work of art, even though there's no background. As Ian seems to think that artists should have wonderful backgrounds and be classically trained, but no, he's just absolutely a marvel.
Yeah, and explain how you have the book organized.
Well, the organization of the book was, in a sense, by Steve Howell. He had experience organizing books this way because he found following conventional taxonomy was just too confusing. So he organized it in a way which he thought was more functionally useful for people.
Yeah.
So the outline of the individual species accounts was more in my bailiwick, and the organization of the book in the overarching sense was more Steve's. It was a cooperative venture in that regard, as was the entire book. It was really quite remarkable. We were all friends beforehand, and it was a long, punishingly long project, 10 years, and projects sort of start out in a euphoric glow, and after a while they become just work.
A slog.
You have to just pound your way through it. But I think in all the years that we were working with this, I don't think there was ever a harsh word among us. And anyone I've talked to who's worked in a multi-author project, has, they sort of cringe when you talk about whether or not there were any conflicts. But this was a conflict-free book, which made the process just wonderful, if not easy.
It's easy to see why it took 10 years. It's a very detailed, wonderfully illustrated, and very well written. What are some of the most incredible cases of vagrants? Do you have some that you think, wow, how did that happen?
Yeah, there were some things that got me interested in this topic. There was an Asian thrush, a Siberian ruby throat, that turned up dead in a garage in Ontario in the fall. And I remember reading about this in North American Birds, and I said, oh, my God, how could this happen? How could this bird have made it all the way over there? That just seemed to defy logic. And you think, well, there was some human immigrant who brought it in a cage. You concoct all sorts of themes to try and explain how this happened. And then shortly thereafter, there was a brown shrike, another Asian shrike, that turned up in Nova Scotia. And as I looked into it, there was this pattern of Asian birds, and most of these were birds that didn't really occur in Western Europe at all, dotted across the country and even ending up to the East Coast. And there's one in Wisconsin, one of the best Wisconsin records of yellow-browed warbler, fits right in this pattern of birds that are Asian. Most of them have representations, although rare, in Alaska in the fall. But they seem to drift all the way across the country, and that said, goodness, this is really more interesting than I thought. So that started the process of thinking about where the rare birds, as measured statistically, came from and what processes were involved to get them to where they ultimately ended up.
Well, this is a fascinating conversation, Will, and you have a wonderful book. I want to thank you so much for taking time to be with us today. It was really a pleasure.
Well, my pleasure too, Larry. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Will Russell, co-founder and managing director of Wings, an international bird tour company. His ornithological interests are varied and have included several years of teaching at the college level. And he and his co-authors spent 10 years on this book, Rare Birds of North America. It was really interesting to me. I hope it was to you, how individual birds end up in very unexpected places. Really fascinating. Coming up next, we're going to zero in on a species that was unbelievably plentiful, but went extinct in a very short time. The last passenger pigeon died 100 years ago, and we're going to hear that story. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.